Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, and my guest today is Sitara Sundar, Head of Alternative Investment Strategy and Market Intelligence in JP Morgan Private Bank. JP Morgan's private bank provides advice to help wealthy clients and their families achieve their financial goals. It oversees more than $2.9 trillion in client assets globally and has been operating for over 200 years. Sitara today leads the development of views across and within alternative investments for the bank. Prior to this role, Sitara has worked across many different parts of the bank. She led the equity specialist team, responsible for providing advice on managed equity portfolios for clients. And prior to that, Sitara supported JP Morgan's chief financial officer on a corporate economics and analytics team, where she was responsible for forecasting global macroeconomic data. And at the start of her career, she supported the firm's chairman of market and investment strategy, Michael Semblist, who authors the hugely popular Eye on the Market publication. I really enjoyed our conversation today, and I think you will too. Sitara, welcome to Alternative Realities.
Thanks so much for having me. Always wonderful to see you.
I'd love to start with some background on your career. What led you to the bank and to your position today?
Yeah, it's a great question. So my career so far has been a varied one. So I've been at JP Morgan for almost a little bit over a decade now, and in a variety of different roles. And the beginning of my career, I worked on what I consider to be a think tank within asset and wealth management. And I supported Michael Semblist, who authors the very well-known and cult-following-like Eye in the Market publication. It's where I really learned how to think about the market critically, how to approach everything from a research perspective or investment perspective with a healthy level of skepticism, and honestly, really what deep fundamental research looked like and to keep pushing to find the truth. And after that, I worked on an economics team that supported JP Morgan CFO. And in there, and in that role, I got a lot of what I believe to be the technical and fundamental expertise that I needed to understand the markets. And my primary function within that was to lead market, macro, and rate variable forecasting for the firm's budget and stress testing exercises. Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting things about that team was I was on that team during the pandemic. And we can all imagine that all of the regressions broke, all of the historical relationships broke within many of these variables. So a lot of what that taught me was to think about how to find the known and the unknown and what we could predict versus what we can't predict and how to create frameworks in thinking about the unknown and what that meant for the firm's balance sheet and how we managed. And then finally, I missed so much talking to clients, trying to advise people on portfolios and how they should invest. So came back to the private bank, and I led an equity specialist team where I oversaw the sales and advice related to the managed equity portfolios that we had in our portfolio in our platform. And most recently, I just was tapped to lead the investment strategy efforts for our alternative business within the private bank. And a long-winded way of saying that, like, I didn't plan it this way. I think people might think that I did, but I didn't.
People rarely do.
But all of these individual experiences from a research perspective, from a portfolio construction perspective, from a thinking about how to tell a data-based narrative, I think led me to a position where I feel like I can do this role well and something that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, and you're certainly bringing together the macroeconomic, the equity stories, the kind of broad look at the market and how the economy works from the Eye on the Markets team. And switching then to your role today in alternatives and working with private bank clients in alternatives, how do private bank clients think about investing in alternatives? I think it's a very interesting kind of set of individuals because they're often business owners. They may be more comfortable with private equity for that reason, or they may own real estate themselves or have made their wealth through what we think of today as alternative assets, right? Not stocks and bonds, kind of the real world assets. So how do clients like this approach alternative investing?
It's interesting because it usually falls into a couple of buckets. People will either look at it for diversification, and either diversification from the assets they personally held, because many of our clients are either financial sponsors themselves or own real estate or in the like, and are active investors in the industry. The other part of it is to think about diversification from a holistic portfolio perspective. And they're looking for something to give them differentiated types of returns versus what they're getting in their traditional 60-40 portfolio, to think about generational wealth and building wealth for their next generation. And then finally, something that I'm sure we'll talk about that has come up increasingly more is folks thinking about the income part of their portfolio, and especially within like private bank clients, thinking about how to generate income within their portfolio outside of just what they're getting within core fixed income and the like. So it's either growth, it's diversification, or it's income oriented. And especially on the growth side, it's thinking about multi-generational wealth, or it's thinking about diversification from their own personal balance sheets. And we've honestly started to see a little bit of a bifurcation even within our client base between those who are generally more on the family office oriented front, where they've kind of been on the forefront of investing within the alternative landscape. And what I mean by that is we do this family office report every year, and we did one in 2024, surveyed like 200 family offices that are out there to figure out a bunch of different questions, but one of them was asset allocation. And what we found out was that 45% of their portfolios were allocated to alternatives. Now, that surprised me, because usually what we see within the broader private bank investing landscape is somewhere closer to 10 to 15% type of allocation. Obviously, balance sheets are different and goals are very different at the end of the day between both of these different cohorts, but it's something that's become increasingly part of the dialogue, not just for the ultra sophisticated, large balance sheet type of clients, but it's something that we're talking about across the entire wealth spectrum.
Right. That's really interesting, because you know, when I think of private bank clients, you brought up real estate, right? If they've made money in real estate, they probably don't want to add more real estate to their portfolio, but they're inherently maybe more comfortable with real assets. Maybe they look at infrastructure or something that gives them diversification.
Yep.
And that large allocation is really interesting. They'd love to explore that. And you know, over time, where you mentioned income, we've seen the solutions to income investing change over time, where it was either it was the zero interest rate regime, where it's really challenging to generate income in the public markets, or it's today with higher inflation, people looking for alternative income sources. How have you seen portfolio allocations to alternatives change over time?
That's a great question. Well, first, it's that even like the definition of what alternative assets means has started to shift over, honestly, like the past decade. I think in the beginning, a lot of folks would think about alternative assets and assume it meant private equity and maybe real estate and like kind of private credit, but not the entire holistic bucket. Now, when we are engaging with clients, and even when they're engaging with us, it's talking about the entire ecosystem and interest in the entire ecosystem. So what does that mean? That's private equity, but that means not just buyout, but like VC and growth as well. That means private credit, but not just senior direct lending, but opportunistic and asset-backed as well. Real assets is more than just real estate. I know we're both infrastructure people. We do love that ecosystem. And infrastructure is starting to become a bigger part of that portfolio and that conversation as well. And last but not least, the hedge fund ecosystem conversation is starting to come up a lot more now. So when we think about allocations moving forward, it's one, looking at that entire holistic bucket and thinking about how to gradate between each and allocate between each of those individual asset classes. But two, it's just that even the definition of what alternatives and the role that alternatives can play within your portfolio has expanded as well. Right. So just be a diversifier. Now it can be a return, an absolute return enhancing engine. And even on the diversification front, to your point on income, this relentless focus, especially over the past couple of years, but brought to fruition so far this year, on the idea of needing inflation resilient income within your portfolio has brought the real asset conversation, of which infrastructure is a big part of that, into the equation too.
Like, huge theme.
It's a huge theme. Like, one of the most interesting things was in this family office report, less than 1%, even though 45% of family office allocations were to alternatives, only 50 basis points of that was in infrastructure. One of the most fascinating things. We've seen institutional allocations to infrastructure kind of increase over the past decade. We haven't seen that as much on the family office and like the private banking side of the equation. We started to see that shift so far this year when we think about flows into each of the individual asset classes. Both infrastructure and hedge funds have been kind of at the top of the stack, which is an interesting trend to see. But I do think that it plays to this point that alternative asset allocations are evolving, and it's evolving to encompass a broader suite of solutions than something that was pretty narrow just a decade ago.
A lot of product evolution.
Yep.
And it's interesting, the infrastructure and hedge funds you're seeing grow in two asset classes that are well known as diversifiers. And
yeah,
at a time
definitely.
Where a lot of volatility in public markets, and that diversification
is the portfolio resilience story, which is a term that has been used ad nauseum so far this year, and understandably so, because when we think about the next decade, and we probably agree on this, is the idea that inflation is likely going to stay elevated versus the prior decade. Rates are likely going to stay elevated versus the prior decade. And economic growth will likely moderate or be at potential a little bit above. So when we think about the building blocks of a portfolio, all of a sudden, you know, maybe the building blocks that you had in like the prior decade where it was low rates and really strong growth and lower inflation, it could still make sense in the future, but parts of that equation are going to have to evolve in lockstep, and the less correlated return streams, of which hedge funds plays into that, and that inflation resilient income like return stream plays into that equation as well, and infrastructure and real estate are both within that bucket.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there. It's really hard to see the returns of the last 2 years in public markets particularly be replicated, but AI is the big question mark, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I know venture obviously is another asset class that is seeing heavy allocations and a lot of interest in areas like that. I want to get back to that. But first, just to stay on this theme of changes in how people are allocating, structures, right? Structures have changed over time as well. We have gone from kind of a private drawdown structure to evergreen structures becoming more popular. Mm-hmm. How are you seeing this play out in the private bank space?
It's one of the most fascinating trends within this ecosystem. And even just this year, we had about well over 5,000 private bank clients invest in Evergreen for the first time. And it's something that I believe is a trend that's going to continue moving forward. Right now, estimates put Evergreen at about 5% of total AUM. Some estimates say that it could grow to 20% of total AUM over the next decade plus. I wouldn't be surprised to see that play out. Now, when we think about from an investment perspective, there's obviously trade-offs between the two. And there are areas where Evergreen makes a lot of sense. And there are areas where drawdown still makes a lot of sense. So one of the biggest things that we try to engage with clients when we had this conversation about structures is talking about the trade-offs between the two, but also talking about it rather than an either-or conversation, an and conversation. Mm. And it's not so dissimilar to how we talk about public markets and we talk about, you know, passive vehicles versus active vehicles and different types of liquidity and how you both can play a really positive and strong role within a portfolio. Evergreen and drawdown kind of had that kind of construct as well. For example, within private credit or infrastructure or real assets, where there's parts of that ecosystem where the returns are maybe a little bit more durable, more income oriented, a little bit lower risk, Evergreen makes a lot of sense in that ecosystem. You get the immediate capital gets put to work immediately, and you get liquidity. So you get the trade-offs make a lot of sense. The opposite side of that equation is the areas of opportunity within real estate, infrastructure, private credit, but even outside of that, that are a little bit more opportunistic in nature, where you want that timing of investment to be a little bit more tactical. Mm. So for the best example of it, I think is within private credit and opportunistic credit, and those that focus on dislocations within the market or increased default rates or anything along those lines, that speed with which you want to put capital to work and where you see those kind of distressed opportunities, you want someone to be able to call that capital and put it into place quickly to capitalize on those kind of dislocations. So in those types of areas, we still think drawdown makes a lot of sense. So at the end of the day, it's a really exciting development. We've seen it in earnest with our own clients. It's an area of the market that we think is going to continue to grow. It's a great structure and it's great innovation. But when we think about portfolios moving forward, it's really important to make sure that both types of vehicles are being used, because both can play very critical roles from an alpha generation perspective and from a durability and income return perspective as well.
Yeah, I love the way you look at that. There are trade-offs. There's uses for both types of structures, and opportunistic type applications are particularly suited for a drawdown vehicle. So you've got capital to deploy when opportunities do come up.
Exactly.
But you may have stretches of time where that capital is sitting and not actively deployed. Which is sort of to the counterpoint of evergreen funds, your capital is being put to work.
And so. Yeah, there's trade-offs always between the two. And even it's one of those things within drawdown that you want to make sure that even if you're one of the biggest things that we advise clients to is to make sure that obviously that capital is invested while it's being waited, waiting to be called, because you want to ensure that the delta in terms of the market returns that you're missing or anything along those lines is as reduced as possible.
Yeah. Staying on that theme of sort of maybe more opportunistic, interesting niche spaces, I know you're doing some work within areas like AI, sports investing, very much in vogue. Can you tell us a little about that?
Oh, it's one of my favorite topics to talk about. So yes. All right. So on the artificial intelligence front, it is fascinating because if we're honest with ourselves, over the past couple of years, we've seen obviously the boom within artificial intelligence and a lot of returns and value accrue within the public market ecosystem, which makes a lot of sense because if we think about the waves or the phases within artificial intelligence, you have the infrastructure starting to get built out, semiconductors, that's where a lot of the value accrued in the beginning over the past couple of years, hyperscalers as well, building out all the pipes. It's like when you think about even the building out of the internet, fiber optic cables, things, the infrastructure needs to get built first, and then the applications came after that. So we're experiencing something very similar within AI right now. Hyperscalers, semiconductors is where a lot of the value has accrued so far, and foundational models, which is a mix of public and private markets. Now, when we think about the next wave and where we're going next, we're increasingly excited and a healthy level of excitement around the software side and the application side of this ecosystem, which we think over the next decade could be anywhere from a $3 to $5 trillion opportunity. So then what does software mean? And like, why is it important within the private markets? One of the stats that surprised me the most was that 95% of software companies are private. So when we think about the next phase of this evolution, it becomes less of a, well, access within private markets would be a nice thing to have because it would complement my exposure that I'm getting within the public markets.
Yeah.
But then it becomes a need to have because all of a sudden, one, when you look at the existing ecosystem, a majority of the companies that are software oriented are private, sure. But then two, the other more theoretical conversation that we end up having is the idea that in the same way that in prior technological innovations, there's a lot of companies that were created that didn't even exist yet, that is the bread and butter of VC and growth equity, where you have all of these companies that need a lot of funding in the very beginning. And for us, whether it's vertical software-oriented companies, horizontal to a certain extent, but those are the areas that we're really excited about on that ecosystem, and ensuring access to private markets and exposure to private markets is critical within that. Sports is another. And the biggest thing here is that it's sports equity, but it's financing of sports as well. Okay. We're seeing opportunities on like both sides of the ecosystem. On the sports equity side, one of the takeaways for clients that we always talk about is that it's more than just a sports team. It's this entire ecosystem that is being built around it. And it's more than just the team. When you think about stadiums, when you think about, again, this like real asset, the real estate, the infrastructure, how old our stadiums are right now, especially when you think about the United States and how much of that needs to be revitalized, how much of that would likely come from a public and private type of partnership from that ecosystem. But then two, sometimes when you're at the beginning of an emerging trend, there is hesitation on going full in on the equity side.
Yeah.
So we've had increasing conversations with folks about the debt side of the equation. And the reason why we're even comfortable with that is because when you look at the majority of sports leagues, a lot of the revenue is based on media rights. And those are multi-year contracts and recurring revenue streams.
Relatively predictable,
and you know you have visibility into what that cash flow stream is going to look like. So we've also increasingly been having conversations with folks about getting access to this exciting theme within sports, but in a more risk-adjusted fashion on the debt side.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I hadn't thought about that before. It's not just the sports teams. We hear about some of these big deals that have been happening, the headlines of teams getting acquired, but the stadiums and everything around that, and how you're structuring this as debt versus equity. Mm-hmm. So it's a really large space with a lot of opportunities. I'd love to end with just your thoughts on, or rather, what you're hearing from clients lately. A lot of volatility in markets. What kind of questions, what kind of discussions are coming up with clients in the recent weeks and months?
Honestly, it's part of what we've already touched on, but it's one of two things. One, there's a lot of conversation taking place about how to make sure that my portfolio is resilient. Mm. It is, if I have to clock the biggest theme of all the client conversations that I've had so far this year, it's been that one. And it's not just resilience against the volatility that we're seeing from a policy perspective and also from a market perspective, but inflation is something that people have to think about a lot more now than I think they've had to think about before. So like that's been a very big topic of conversation, and I never thought that I was going to talk about infrastructure and real estate and real assets as much as I have so far this year, but I have, and there's a lot of real reason for that, one side of it. Two, this like idea of companies staying private for longer is starting to come up more and more now. And it's an intriguing one because it's a theme that we've all collectively talked about quite a bit. The median age to IPO is like mid-teens, like 14 years, something along those lines. It's been increasing over time. But a lot of the conversations now, too, is around not that they are staying private for longer, but why are they staying private for longer? And there's been a lot of prominent examples within the AI ecosystem where there is an abundance of private capital in the ecosystem right now, especially if you think about how much private equity AUM has risen over the past 10 years. It's been clipping or at like a 15% annualized rate when you think about AUM growth. There's an abundance of capital where there's a lot of companies that are now able to access that capital, stay private. So what that means from a investment perspective is that you want to ensure, like it's the biggest thing, this like public-private convergence. What does that mean? Where are we seeing an evolution within this ecosystem? Where we're having a lot more conversations with clients, or they're coming to us and asking about within their equity sleeve, Like, should I be thinking about just public equity? Should I be thinking about public and private together? Or like, how do I incorporate this evolution into how I think about my equity portfolio? And for us, what that means is, like, one, private equity is, you know, not just a story about an illiquidity premium over public markets, but it's a differentiated earnings growth story too.
Right, because you're expanding the opportunity set.
100%. So it's a differentiated earnings growth story, which is one part of it. And then the second part of it is we've started to see inklings, our own investment bank put out, you know, initiated research on a private company, and we're starting to see more and more kind of institutionalization of many parts of the private ecosystem, which also means that the idea of what equities mean within a portfolio, what fixed income or credit means and debt means within a portfolio is starting to shift as well. And that's been the second major trend in terms of client conversation so far this year. It's fascinating.
It's amazing, yeah. So looking at public and private as sort of a continuum.
A continuum, exactly that.
Yeah. Sitara, this has been fantastic. Thank you very much for coming on Alternative Realities.
Thank you for having me. This is a great conversation. Thank you.
That was Sitara Sundar, Head of Alternative Investment Strategy and Market Intelligence at JP Morgan Private Bank. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our quarterly guide to alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on all the major podcasting platforms.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.